here this afternoon. I'm out of the country when Ajahn Sumedho is arranging these talks, and so I come back to find out what titles he's chosen. So I inherit something of his what inspires him, or what subjects he is interested to speak on, and things he feels would be interesting, useful for people in general. And I have no idea exactly what he was going to speak about on the subject of spiritual friendship, but since it's such a major part of our life in Buddhist practice, particularly in our monastic life, oftentimes when I've had to do these talks before, I've asked him, I said, well, what were you going to talk about, or what did you want to bring up, or hear? As if I felt I had to transmit or be his, be the voice for him. But this is such a rich topic, there's so much to be said on it, I thought, well, I don't even really need to consult him or to think about it in any way. One of the aspects of the style of our monastic life, there are many different kinds of Buddhist practice and different kinds of Buddhist monasteries. And in the Theravadan countries, there's the tradition of forest monasticism, or the old style of meditation monasteries. Very often the style of practice that's praised is one of going off and living in the countryside, being alone, finding solitude, and practicing meditation by yourself off in the woods, and being as far away from other people as you can. And certainly our teacher Ajahn Chah practiced in this way for many years. But he was notable insofar as that he also, after spending about 20 years traveling and living on his own, meditating on his own, that he actually built his style of practice and teaching in the latter part of his life, the last 25 years, and all his teaching career was built around spiritual community. That he realized that that there was a problem that he had, that whereas he could go off into the hills and be alone and develop profound states of concentration and have all kinds of interesting and deep experiences. But then when he came back and lived with other people, when he had to stay with other monks, he could only cope for about 3 or 4 days, and then he'd lose his temper and get upset and angry and annoyed and irritated about how incompetent and useless everybody else was. And so he realized after a few years of this that he had some lessons to learn. And he thought, well, it's easy for me to go off and be alone and be the fierce ascetic off in the forest. What's difficult is to be with other people, to learn how to spend time with others. And so he put himself in that position more and more, and developed his monasteries around that style, so that we live very communally. We live very close to each other, and often his monasteries were criticized because of the fact that they say, well, you know, the monks and nuns, they don't have any time to meditate. They're always working. They're always seen that everyone has to spend so much time together. You have all the chanting together, meditation together. This is a real headache. This is an obstruction. You know, what you should really be doing is being off and being alone. And so he would be criticized for that. But he listened and understood the criticism, but was never budged by it, was never intimidated by it, because he saw that there's very profound lessons to be learned and great richness in learning to live together with other people, and the fact of spiritual community or spiritual friendship is really that which holds the spiritual life together. And it's interesting that of all of the meditation masters in Thailand, it's not that one is keeping a score, but Ajahn Chah has managed to found, or his disciples have founded, about 130, 140 different branch monasteries in Thailand. And there's no other meditation teacher or any other monastery that has remotely that number. So that what this means is that even though on one level the sort of hardcore meditators might criticize the style of practice, actually on the human level it really works. It's very appealing, and it functions for ordinary human beings. That we realize that to develop in the spiritual life, we need each other. We need support. We need companions in the spiritual life. And without that, we tend to drift or sink. As a very often quoted saying from the scriptures on spiritual friendship, and I asked Morris, distinguished Buddhist scholar here in the staying in Amaravati, because that, of course I hadn't got a clue whereabouts it was in the scriptures, but he was able to find it for me. But it's a conversation between Ananda, who was the Buddha's closest disciple, and the Buddha, and Ananda was a very sweet character, but a little bit light-headed. And he was like the Buddha's personal attendant for many, many years, and was not very highly regarded by the other monks. He was a nice fellow, but not quite as wise as Sariputta, or as powerful as Moggallana, or as ascetic as Mahakasapa. But anyway, one day he came up to the Buddha and said I think that at least half of the spiritual life, half of the holy life, is friendship with the lovely, is association with the lovely. And the Buddha replied, "That's not so. Say not so, Ananda. Say not so. It's not half the holy life. It is the whole of the holy life. The entire holy life is friendship, association with the lovely." And the word friendship with the lovely is in the Pali Kalyanamita. Kalyana means lovely or beautiful, and mita means friend. So oftentimes this is translated as spiritual friendship. Other times it's translated as affiliation or association with the lovely, as with lovely with a capital L, being an epithet for ultimate reality, or the unconditioned. And so that it's interesting that for myself, I certainly for years always interpreted this as saying, you know, spiritual friendship is the whole of the holy life. What you find is that most accurately what the Buddha was saying was that it's not just spiritual friendship, not having spiritual friends, that is the whole of the holy life. But our affiliation, our association, our intimacy with the lovely, with the wonderful, with the ultimate truth, that these two support each other. That it's the support that we derive from our spiritual friends, our like-minded companions and associates in spiritual life, that supports our efforts. But it's actually our ability to know and to awaken to, and to affiliate ourselves with that which is truly lovely, that which is the beautiful, the wonderful, the ultimate reality. That is in its own way. That is also the very fire or the power of our spiritual life itself. That these two qualities support each other. That association. Affiliation with the lovely supports our spiritual friendship. That's what enables us to live in true friendship with each other, true and profound heartfelt friendship, a friendship without attachment. And also that friendship association with other like-minded people, that helps us to empower and deepen our insight into truth. Or when we think of the word spiritual friendship, it's helpful to contemplate what that means. What do we mean by spiritual friendship? Is it a kind of friendship? Does it mean that it's the kind of people that you meet in Buddhist monasteries, or does a spiritual friend have to have a shaved head, or do they have to be? Does this imply your husband, your wife, your life companion? There are many different kinds of relationship, of friendship that we can have, and we might think, well, which ones are spiritual and which ones are not spiritual? You know, can you have a romantic friendship which is spiritual? Or do spiritual friendships have to be unromantic? Is it impossible to be a spiritual friend of your wife or your husband? Is that, off the menu? Or is that possible? Does a spiritual friendship have to be platonic? Does it have to be, is it in terms of a teacher, a student, or is it in terms of brother or sister, elder or younger? But rather than say dividing up, a friendship or categorizing it in that way, or trying to figure out which styles of relationship or friendship are spiritual and which ones aren't, it's much more important to look at the basis of the relationship. You know, what's your approach towards it? Because there's I like to divide relationships up into two basic categories, whether they're between teachers and students, whether they're romantic or platonic, or between any people whatsoever. And these are describing how in some ways we tend to relate through a quality of separateness, another way we relate through a quality of wholeness. Now, what I mean by a relationship of separateness is where there's a, in terms of you with a friend or with a parent or a teacher or student or child or whatever, that there's a profound sense of me and you. There's a sense of self and other. And that that is something which is very concrete, solid, and that we take that for granted. We look at that as being something absolute and real. And so that any kind of effort that we make on that towards that friendship or furthering that friendship is always based around that idea, and that we tend to look then upon the other person as somehow fulfilling a need that we have, as a say we experience a gap or a lack in ourselves, and that other person fills that space, they fill that gap, and so that a relationship or a friendship that is based in this way, it's always going to have a quality of dependency in it. It's going to be, we need that other person to be around in order to support us or to make us feel good. Or even we need to have that other person around to have an enemy or to have someone that we, a good protagonist that we can struggle with. But there's a neediness that's in us. And that that kind of relationship, even though it might be very, very intense or very profound, like being profoundly in love with someone, so that there are times of that are very blissful, or where one does experience a sense of wholeness or completeness, that along with that is going to continually or repeatedly lead to the feelings of desolation, of loneliness, of separateness, of loss. There is a quality to it that even though that friendship might be very strong, that will be leading to the feelings of dukkha, of incompleteness. So that if we try to if we look upon someone like a spiritual friend, or someone that you regard as a teacher, or a helper, or someone that you're in a relationship with, and we develop the relationship around that pattern, then no matter how much time you spend meditating together, or you you have a profound understanding, or you kind of see into each other's innermost world, and you are kind of supported or helped by that other person. As long as that relationship is based on a sense of me and a sense of you, and that's not recognized, then there will always be the quality of loss. There will be a shadow to it. There will be a quality of pain to it. There's an incident in the scriptures where I think it was Visakha came to the Buddha, and she'd just come from a blessing for one of her grandchildren. Visakha was one of the Buddha's great disciples and she was supposed to have had 10 sons and 10 daughters, and each of those had 10 sons and 10 daughters, and so she was surrounded by an ocean of grandchildren, and she adored them, and so she showed up at the Buddha's monastery one morning, and she'd just come from a blessing ceremony for one of her ocean of grandchildren, and the Buddha saw her and said, "Well, you're looking very happy." And she was covered with her hair was all wet from being sprinkled by water in the blessing ceremony. And he said, "You're looking very happy and your hair's all wet. What have you just come from?" And she said, "Oh, I've just come from the blessing for my grandchild. Oh, you know, it's so marvelous." And the Buddha said, "Do you like having grandchildren?" She said, "Oh, yes, it's marvelous. I wish I had as many grandchildren as there are people in the whole city of Sarvati," which is like the local capital. And the Buddha says, "Really? Well, how many people die every day in Sarvati?" He says, "Oh, 10, 20, 30 people die every day." He said, "Well, if you had as many grandchildren as there were people in Sarvati, then you'd be attending 10 or 20 or 30 funerals for your offspring every day." She said, "Oh, I didn't think of that." And he said that the ones who are dear to us, quality of attachment or possessiveness that we have towards others, it is beautiful and delicious and lovely, but it brings us pain. It carries a sting with it. It carries a shadow with it. And this is unavoidable. If we invest in that the delight of association, of affiliation in that way, then when there's separation, we automatically can't avoid feeling loss. So trying to base a spiritual friendship simply around those qualities, is never going to work. It's always going to have this slightly imbalanced quality to it. Now, on the other side, what I would refer to, or what I like to call relationships of wholeness, is where our association with another person, our friendship or our partnership or however we might be connected with them as a teacher, a student, a parent, child, or whatever, that's based on not around the sense of self at all. It's based around a quality of relinquishment of unselfishness of openness rather than neediness. And this can be developed in different ways. A lot of the devotional practices of spiritual life, of religious life, are very much towards this. It's by creating an idealized figure, towards the Buddha or towards God or Jesus or towards Krishna or whoever it might be, or some living person towards a guru, that by giving yourself in devotion to that divine figure, whether it's visible or invisible, that act of self-giving, of self-relinquishment, even though it's in one sense to an object or to a person, the process works by the fact that it's like a divine person or a divine presence, so that in a way it's forming some kind of a bond between yourself and the other. But at the same time, the more that self-giving occurs, then it has a quality of release, a quality of of say bringing openness, of bringing joy. It doesn't bring a state of dependence. So this is how devotional practices work. It's like by giving yourself up completely to the divine, whether it's internal or external, whether you create an object for it, or you have a divine a person who has divine qualities, or who you look upon, or who exhibits divine qualities, or you look upon in that way, then you can bring about this same kind of like truly spiritual relationship, where it's you're fixating upon that person. But the more that you open the mind to them, the more that you give yourself to that object, to that person, then the result is you start to internalize that quality. So that last weekend, say, we had a conference for contemplatives here. We had a whole great gang of different Christian nuns and monks of all different orders, and some Hindu and some Sufi people. And it was interesting talking to them, because for much of their, for most other traditions, the Buddhists are quite unusual in being a non-theistic religion. But most of them have a very strong God figure that becomes the focus of their attention. And that the whole way that they speak in their prayers and their liturgy, and the whole manner of religious expression, is around devotion to God, or giving yourself to God, or praying to God, or giving up your heart to Jesus or Mary or Krishna. And then talking with them, it was apparent that the effect that this has is that the more that you do it, the more that you're not only seeing, say, Krishna or God outside, but also inside as well. And the effect of pursuing this kind of practice for many years is that you find yourself, through this process of self-relinquishment, you find there's a complete identification with that divine figure. So that then they say, like, eventually you realize that you are Krishna, or you are Christ, or you are... like in Sufi tradition, they often use the term the beloved. As in Sufi mystical poetry, they often refer to ultimate reality, or the divine. They use the term the beloved, and their verses that they use or have sprung up from their tradition. It moves back and forth between being sounding like a love song between someone and the person that they love, and a love affair between the individual and the divine, and that you can see that in some of the Sufi poetry, that the whole process of spiritual practice ends up with realizing that you are the beloved, that there never was any difference. There never was any separateness. There never was any division between you as an apparent individual and the divine or God or ultimate reality that seemed to be somewhere else. Now, the other way of developing this kind of relationship based around wholeness is simply just the more less than a devotional approach, and more of an approach of meditation and wisdom, whereby one is, through practice, through meditation, becoming aware and acquainted with how much we create the sense of self, and through letting go very directly of the sense of I and me and mine in our daily activity, in our work, in our actions, just a process of self-relinquishment without using any kind of external object or being or deity to empower that or to strengthen that, just through the power of inquiry and introspection, of contemplation, of using the power of the mind to simply break through the sense of self. And that has the same effect. That has the same quality, of opening the mind and allowing a relationship to be one which encourages you to do that. It doesn't encourage self-centeredness. It doesn't encourage the strengthening of the sense of self, but rather it encourages us to break through that, encourages us to say not be bound by that. And any kind of a friendship or relationship that is developed or based in this way is always going to have a freedom from that sense of dukkha, of incompleteness or dissatisfaction. That if I relate to you in this way of if I let go of myself, if I don't think of myself, if I drop the feeling of I and me and mine, then the experience of being with you is one of delight, of pleasantness, so that then our association with each other is delightful, but it's not one of neediness. It's not as though, you know, I need to be around a particular person or a particular thing, or to have someone say I love you or I admire you or someone to indicate they even care about me. That there isn't a quality of neediness to that association, to that friendship, and so that when there is not that neediness, there's a tremendous freedom. So we can enjoy each other's company, we can be supported by each other, but we're not requiring that. There's not a sense of, it's not based on a loneliness or a hunger that we have. Is not based on a sense of incompleteness. In this light, it's helpful to recognize that you can develop this kind of friendship around with your brothers and sisters, with your children, with the people that you're married to, or with people who are elder, younger, teachers, students, that those kind of categories are completely open. It's up to us how we develop a relationship. In those terms, so that even if it's someone that you have a romantic relationship with or that you're married to, this can easily be, or not, maybe not easily, but can certainly be developed in terms of a spiritual relationship, a relationship that's not based on mutual dependency and a neediness, but a relationship of mutual support. This is in a monastic life, or in a spiritual training. You know, your relationship with your teacher doesn't have to depend on the teacher needing to the elder needing to have people who admire them and listen to them and think that they're wonderful. And tell them that they're wonderful. Say, oh yes, Ajahn Sumedho, you are marvelous. Oh, really? Oh yes, really. Say, oh, Ajahn Amaro, I think you're so wonderful. Oh, truly? Oh, you've got such wonderful judgment. You know, it's not as though you have to have students or people who tell you that, or you have to have a teacher that you can admire and look up to. You can enjoy each other's company and learn and benefit from each other. And liberate each other rather than bind each other, and this is the essential quality of a spiritual friendship. It's where the result of it is liberation rather than binding. There, one person that I met who's a teacher. A spiritual teacher, he put it in terms of he spent a lot of time, he and his wife, over the years. They teach a lot of meditation workshops, and they teach a lot of workshops also just around the whole quality of relationship and using relationship as a spiritual path. And they say the only way that they found, they're both pretty hot characters, and they say the only way that they find that it works for them is that if they see each other as a mirror, that the other person is like a mirror for that in them which is the lovely. Say, if I if I see him or if he sees her or she sees him, is that if they see each other as a mirror, and that what you relate to as the loveliness of the other person, you see that as a reflection of that in you, which is truly lovely, like the lovely with a capital L, then it works. If you think that the lovely is located in the other person, or if they're relating to the that in you, that you are the source of beauty, you are the source of happiness, and I've got to get it from you, or you have to provide it for me, then they find themselves in a contracted, locked, and tense state. But as soon as they relate to each other in terms of you enable me to awaken to the lovely within myself, and therefore I celebrate your presence. I delight in your presence for what you are and the fact that you help this awakening to occur. Then there's appreciation, there's delight, there's openness, and there's not a sense of imprisonment. I just came back where I was before. Where I go every summer is to West Coast of America, and they have a whole culture there around personalized number plates and bumper stickers. I think many PhDs have been written on this subject, and they have a. It's amazing. They have a. The number plates have either seven letters or seven numbers, and you can form them into any combination that you like, and it's extraordinary how someone can express their statement to the, you know, complete statement to the universe in the space of seven letters. But I won't go into any of them. But the bumper sticker that I was thinking about this talk, and I saw this bumper sticker this year. I don't know if the terminology will be very strange to you, but certainly in West Coast America, it's very familiar in the sort of meditation psychological circles. And this bumper sticker said, to err is dysfunctional, to forgive is codependent. There's a whole culture of blaming our problems in life on being born into a dysfunctional family or having a dysfunctional relationship. And then not only is being dysfunctional bad, but then if you're locked into a relationship where you can't love them, but you can't leave them, and that you find that you are dependent upon a person, but the relationship is very destructive, and you can't live with them, and you can't live without them. This is a kind of no-win situation. This is called known as codependency, like supporting an alcoholic spouse. Looking after them, but also helping them to destroy themselves. You can't stay with them, you can't stay without them. So this is the kind of thing that a wholesome and true spiritual friendship will dissolve. That spiritual friendship does not mean being drinking partners. Friendship in spirit. Now that the aspect of spiritual friendship, to see it both that spiritual friendship supports our affiliation with the lovely, and our affiliation with the lovely, our realization of truth, our awakening to truth supports spiritualizes our friendships. This is the crux of this whole area of our life, because these two support each other. If we try to establish a spiritual friendship but we have no real understanding or intuition or feeling for true spiritual beauty, for the lovely, or for truth, then that we can never establish, our friendships will always end up being dysfunctional and codependent and so on. But if we try to establish a spiritual life, we try to live with an awareness of, or an intimacy with truth, but we don't have any spiritual companions, we don't have any kind of support system, both of those efforts will fail. Both of those efforts will not bring any really good result. The two need each other. But these two qualities support each other. And this is what the Buddhist community, ideally, the fourfold community of Buddhist people symbolizes or embodies. This is the laymen, laywomen, Buddhist nuns, Buddhist monks. The fourfold community is, in its essence, is its whole life is built around embodying these qualities of both empowering and strengthening, and giving opportunity to give insight into truth, but also providing the social situation and social support system to encourage that and to empower that. And then the relationship within the Buddhist community is one of wholesomeness, of friendliness, but without clinging or attachment. I think this is a lot of the reason why, as monastics, we're homeless, that we have to be on the move. We have to learn how to drop everything and go. If it takes you more than half an hour to pack, you know that you're stuck to a place. I try to make a rule, if I'm going to move rooms, if it takes me more than two loads to carry my things from one room to the next, then I know I've got too many objects, too many possessions, so I need to offload a little bit. And that sense of movability, of being ready to leave everything behind and to go, is a great sign for us. Like the Buddha described his disciples saying, you know, one who is wise lives like a bird in flight. That a bird takes everything it owns wherever it goes, and that for people who are followers of the Buddha's way, or respect people who respect the Buddha's way, that's a good example to take. That we take everything that we need with us wherever we go, and leave no trace behind, like a bird in the sky, it's trackless. And so, in the same way, this is how we should, or we aim to develop our spiritual friendships, so that when you're in the company of others, you're supported by them, you're delighted in their company. But then, when you're away from them, that you don't miss them, that you don't create a sense of longing or lack in your mind, needing to be with individual people. The blessings that come from developing spiritual friendship, are many, because even though there might be some individuals who are capable of say maintaining their spiritual life alone, and often regularly we meet people who say, I live up in Ochtomachty, and there isn't another Buddhist for 50 miles. And I've been struggling away for years and years. And I feel really impressed by people who live off in the wilds, or they come from Paraguay or somewhere. And you think, my goodness, how many Buddhists are there in Paraguay? And it's quite a few, actually. I'm always impressed by how people can manage to maintain their spiritual life and practice, far away from other people. But it takes a tremendous strength to do it, and to actually not to just keep breathing, but to actually develop any profound understanding and real penetration of truth. There may be a handful of people that can do it on their own without a supportive spiritual family. But I think the numbers are very, very small. I reckon, a rough estimate, I reckon about 1 in 100 million can pull it off on their own. The rest of us, my experience has been, and even though some people like to be alone, they prefer not to have others around, I often feel that it's rather like Ajahn Chah's experience of feeling that he liked being alone. He could enjoy himself marvelously being off in the forest without other people to bother him. But some people say, well, I really enjoy practicing alone. But oftentimes it's because if you're around other people, they keep annoying you. They don't have they offend your opinions. They upset you. And so that if our spiritual life is upsettable, then it's really not very strong or complete or independent. And true spiritual maturity has this quality of independence. Regardless of what the world throws at us, that we don't wobble, we don't crumple or sink. So that I certainly myself deeply value the coming across the Sangha. When I guess I started out on my sort of spiritual my sort of vague attempts at spiritual practice as a teenager. But by the time I got to 21, I was in a profound mess, and when I came across this particular monastic community in Thailand, what really moved me, or what really impressed me, was just how powerful a presence that was. Just knowing that I should meditate, or I should practice yoga, or it would be a good idea to stop drinking or smoking or whatever. Never just knowing that it was a good thing to do did not have anything like the power necessary to actually break the habit or move against the momentum of the activities of people around me. Just what was normal for everyone around me. And that suddenly being in a place where people had given up all the things that I was trying to give up, and they were doing all the things that I was trying to do, it was rather like just stepping onto a bus that was heading in the right direction. At last, I didn't have to struggle on my own. And that even though from an idealistic position, you say, well, if you can do it on your own, then that's really the best. I realized that even though I was pretty highly motivated as a human being, as a person, I just did not have the strength or the clarity of mind to sustain a true and an honest spiritual perspective. Too easily I would take the path of least resistance and call it going with the flow and being free, or you don't want to be hung up about this, or you don't want to get uptight about that, or you're in a way just following your own fears, fear of difficulty and pain. You're following your own desire for pleasure and comfort and calling it spirituality. And that it's very easy to be dishonest with oneself. And I found that living amongst like-minded people and having a group commitment towards truth, towards honesty, towards consistent spiritual work, it provided a marvelous mirror, a great mirror to see my own preferences, my own fears, my own shortcomings. That became apparent, and so that I can see as one of the great blessings of living with or giving oneself to a spiritual community or a standard of spiritual teachings, is that you have a very clear objective measure for the conditioning of your own mind, your own karma. It's like watching the habits of your mind being projected onto a screen. It's like rather than just following them around and never really seeing them, in a way you get to be able to stand back from them and see them for what they are, what you always run away from, what you always are pulled towards, what you seek as a place of comfort and safety, what makes you feel good, what makes you feel bad. And that kind of objectivity enables us to no longer be imprisoned by that, no longer to be dragged around by that. Once you can see it, then you're able to witness it just as the playing out of karma, and then you are able to transcend. That karma can be transcended. So, you know, in developing spiritual friendship, this is, I think, very much what these kind of events, the Sunday afternoon talks, or the different things that happen here at Amaravati, this monastery, this place is designed to be an environment where spiritual friendship can be cultivated, where, you know, those qualities of our own being can be developed, which enable us to live in an open, in an unself-centered way, that meditation classes, retreats, but also just the gatherings of people coming to offer alms food, or just coming to visit for the day, the festival days. I learned another word in America this year, which is schmoozing, to schmooze. I think it's a Yiddish word. It means to sort of hang out and just loaf around with your friends and chat and talk and drink tea and do nothing very much. Just have a good time together, schmoozing. So to schmooze is a very... admirable and useful activity. I'm not being facetious in this, because it's amazing how often people who are interested in spiritual practice, or interested in Buddhism or meditation, and they'll come to a center like this, and they'll listen to a talk, or they'll come and do a retreat, and then as soon as it's over, everyone goes home. And sometimes you go to Buddhist groups for years, and you find that the people in the group hardly know each other. Some people don't even know, you know, they don't know anything about them. They don't know what work they do, where they live, if they're married, they're not married, if they have children, or anything about them. And that a part of developing our spiritual life, or our ability to live from spiritual reality, is to give ourselves to each other, to spend time with each other, to create to generate a sense of respect and gratitude for each other's interest and commitment to spiritual values, to give time to each other, to give our attention to each other, not to just think, oh, well, the talk's over, now it's time to go home, or the retreat's finished, now I'll go off and I've got this and that to do. But to actually to get to know the other people in this world who are interested in the things that you are, who respect, who delight at the Buddha's teachings, who delight in stillness, in silence, who delight in peacefulness, to create that kind of connection. Because this is the support system, this is the Kalyana Mitta network, the network of spiritual friendship. This is what really enables us as a human society to hold together. Political agreements don't work. Laws don't work. It's our ability to strengthen and affirm our qualities of grandeur, of inner beauty, of kindness, of generosity, and to encourage those in others. That's what holds the society together. That's what enables human beings to live in a wholesome and profitable way. And this works even with people that we do know, people that we're very close to, or that we know very well. It's just to, you know, to develop the spiritual friendship is to, in a way, to listen to each other. You know, when you're spending time with other people, to actually be with each other, to open yourself to the other person, to be ready to notice the grudges that you have, or the opinions that you have about other people, and to even the obsessions that you have about them, or the attraction that you have towards them, to just to be ready to drop those aspects of relationship, to be able to just not be driven by those superficial aspects, and to enter more into the place of listening, of forgiving, of letting go of the past and just being open to the present and committing your attention to another person. And this is the most wonderful and beautiful gift that we can give. Also, to notice the qualities of neediness that we have, like to contemplate the different relationships that you have with your children, your parents, your, because you think, well, these are my spiritual friends and these are my unspiritual friends. You know, this is the bloke I work with, and well, you know what he's like, and we are great pigeonholers in this way. But there's no reason why every association that we have with any other person need not be a spiritual friendship, even if they don't realize it. You have to run sort of undercover operations, so that even if they don't see them in that way themselves in that way, there's nothing to stop me from relating to everybody else in terms of their spiritual reality. So that to take the trouble to do that, to notice where we are creating opinions or creating judgments about other people, or creating a need to notice that neediness within us, that which likes to possess and to hang on to others, that which derives a sense of being and delight in the presence of another. And this is extremely hard to do, but just to notice it, when I'm not talking about just sort of trying to switch it off and make it not be there, but just to notice what is happening. Like if you have children or grandchildren that you dearly love in particular, that kind of relationship, that is, you know, some child that is totally lovable, you know, then just to notice that feeling of adoration. Not saying, you know, I should stop feeling that quality of affection or love or profound delight, but just to notice, here is this feeling of intense attraction, delight, adoration, and how would one feel if that child died or was lost? How would I feel if I lost that person? Just to notice how much is being created, how much we create that sense of our importance, of our meaningfulness out of the presence of others. You know, I remember talking with a friend of ours in Ireland, and she said that when she got married, she had absolutely no intention of having any children, and she ended up with four daughters. And she said, and all the time she's saying, this is ridiculous, I can't stand this, this is hopeless, but found herself totally immersed in the world of her daughters and spending every hour of the day and night looking after them, caring for them, and at the same time thinking, I don't want to do this, this is terrible, this is a ghastly mistake, but emotionally, very tightly bound to them. And then a few years ago, I was talking with her, and she said, I can't believe it, you know, after all this struggle with having our own children and bringing them up, yeah, and my eldest daughter is only 11, and already I'm thinking about grandchildren. And she realized that there was something in her that was in a way needed to be needed. She loved being something in her that really loved being needed, and that sometimes very very frequently that. And particularly in such a dispersed society as we have now, we have such a fragmented family. The nuclear family has exploded, had a nuclear explosion, whereas the Asian family tends to have to be very much a group affair with loads of aunts and uncles and cousins and grannies and grandpas and great uncles and aunts around. We're very much a fragmented society, and so people who are parents or grandparents, elder people in particular, often find themselves very alone, and then their sense of usefulness or importance only comes out of their children or their grandchildren, and that that gives one a sense of being, a sense of reality. And when that's gone, then you feel like, I'm useless. I'm a useless person. I'm a spare part. What am I contributing? And so that can be a very powerful instinct. And if we don't see that, then that will continually invest. You know, the things that do give us that sense of importance, give us that sense of meaning and reality, we'll continually hang on to them and invest in them and create a bondage around that. But just to recognize that's what's happening, to be able to see this is what's happening, that is a step towards the transcendence of it, that you're able to delight in the same way in your children, your grandchildren. But it's something that is not you're not dependent upon, that you're not requiring. It's something that is just delighting in the natural beauty of the world. You say, oh, well, when you meet a beautiful child, and when this is your child or your grandchild, then delight is right there. But it's a delight which is freeing, which is liberating, not something which is, we are taking to be the source of our happiness, or the only place where true happiness can be found. So I see that 3 o'clock has come around, so I'll offer these thoughts for you to consider. I think we'll have a break now for 10 minutes, and then open things up for questions.